This podcast is brought to you by GE. Imagination at work.
It was like a switch came on in my brain.
Prodigy comes from the Latin prodigium.
We didn't realize it was special.
A monster that violates the natural order.
I mean, they were just so bright. They just caught on to everything.
One of our very best and at an extremely young age.
They have this extreme memory. They have the amazing attention to detail.
Transform the mundane into the memorable.
Different. Therefore, we're somewhat suspicious of them.
It's true. Yeah, we are prodigies.
I'm Lily Cerner, and welcome again to Decoding Genius. Thomas Edison once said, if we did all of the things we're capable of, we would literally astound ourselves. It's a reminder that we don't fully understand our own abilities. And that's especially true of young prodigies, the genius of children for whom great accomplishments are commonplace. This week, we'll meet a pair of brothers who have a genius for the arts. One an artist, the other a musician. But the most astounding part of their story is how they got their incredible talents.
I think other people saw it first, to be honest. We were a little bit daft.
In the end, though, the true magic of their genius lies in the gifts they have to share.
The answer to child prodigies may give us clues to autism and also to genius.
For GE, this is Decoding Genius. The story of Josh and Zach Thiessen, two brothers in Canada with extraordinary talents, doesn't fit the pattern of any geniuses we've met so far in this series. Indeed, their story is so gobsmackingly incredible, it doesn't match any pattern you've ever heard or imagined before. Josh is the older brother. He's now 21. He's been an astonishing painter since he was a toddler growing up in Moscow.
Yeah, well, I had a Russian nanny who did lots of arts and crafts with me from a very young age. She would hold up my stuffed animals, teaching me how to draw them with shading and perspective. And so my nanny and my parents began to quietly believe that I may have a special gift for art.
He had his first public exhibition at the age of 11 and is now considered one of the masters of modern realism.
One of our very best and at an extremely young age, which is fairly incredible.
That's the opinion of Don Clapper, the president of the International Guild of Realism. He's an internationally renowned expert in this unique genre of art.
I think Josh is 21 now. We met him when he was 17. He's won some of our biggest awards. His paintings are selling. I think he's a total genius. He's a phenom. Actually, I should buy one of his paintings now. I think they'd be great investments.
My original sell for $2,000 for the smaller ones, up to $24,000 for the large paintings. And at this point, I've sold over 80 originals of my work to national and international collectors.
His brother Zach is just a year younger, and he's a phenomenal musician.
I'd say my preferred styles are definitely a jazz influence in terms of the technicalities of the beats and the time signatures and the rhythms. Classical for more of the ambient and clean, kind of pretty sounding parts. I've had so far one EP come out and two singles separately, and just getting ready to release an EP next month.
The boys' talents are both world-class. Even in adults, that level of ability would be one in a million. But because they came into their own so quickly and so young, it puts them in a special class of genius, prodigies.
So prodigies are usually, the term is usually referring to young people who are able to work at an adult level.
Michelle Juradovich is an expert in gifted children. I spoke to her in Brisbane to get a definition of prodigy, genius, and savant.
So we immediately think of Mozart, and we think of children who are doing work at extraordinary levels. Many of these go on to be adult geniuses, but the prodigy refers to the age at which they are when they're producing adult-like work. So geniuses, we would say, are generally about a level of ability. So they are truly exceptional in their capacity. In current terms, we talk about this as being an IQ of 160. Savants are usually twice exceptional individuals, so they are high ability individuals who also have an area of disability. So often we think of people with autism who have an area of disability in their social communication and the way in which they may do day-to-day tasks, but at the same time they have an extraordinary capacity in a certain area. You would probably remember the Dustin Hoffman movie Rain Man, where he played a savant who had autism but also had an extraordinary capacity with numbers.
Wearing the label of prodigy is not always complimentary.
Prodigy comes from the Latin prodigium, which means a monster that violates the natural order. These exceptional minds, be they genius prodigies or savants, are different to the norm. Therefore, we're somewhat suspicious of them, I think.
Finding one child with exceptional talents is rare. Finding two under the same roof is exceptionally rare. But here they are. My first hunch was that there's something in the way that they were raised. But their parents, Doug and Julie, say that this isn't so.
You know, we say they kind of came this way. Well, Josh especially.
Yeah, both of them were really good students. I mean, they were in the school system till they were in grade 3 and 4. And then I started homeschooling them. They were so easy to teach. I mean, they were just so bright. They just caught on to everything. I mean, Zach soaked up math and science and stuff so quickly, I had to sort of hold him back so he wouldn't pass Josh, who was just a year older than him.
Despite Josh and Zach's success in school, their parents didn't clue in that they were gifted.
I think other people saw it first, to be honest. We were a little bit daft in that we just thought, okay, our kids are pretty good. Josh is pretty good at art, you know, but lots of kids are. And I remember other parents who had children who were a bit older said, just so you know, Zach's the normal child. You know, because with Josh, he's just not normal. And I was a little offended by that at first, but I gradually understood more and more what they meant. Zach was really typical. He was just an active little boy who went from one thing to the next and loved toys and broke things that other kids had played for years.
But Josh was not typical in that he wasn't active and
he was more serious right from the start. He was serious and focused, had ideas and was creative. Very much wanted to make his own artwork, draw his own pictures, would not color in coloring books. He wanted to create his own creations.
The story gets really bizarre when you dig into Zach's journey a little bit deeper. You see, his incredible musical skills didn't emerge until his teens. It arose in the weeks and months following a serious head injury.
The accident happened at a church youth group gathering. I was kind of a crazy child growing up, so we created this really kind of dangerous game where we do like high jumps over these big washing machine boxes. And since I'm really competitive, I did like a head first dive over it, not thinking. And I just like smacked my head on like a very, very thinly carpeted like concrete floor, basically. So it knocked me out pretty good.
At first, they chalked it up to just Zach being Zach.
I think that was about his 9th concussion. Mm-hmm. So we had the little concussion page from the emergency taped to the inside of the medicine cabinet. So we knew the whole routine, what we were supposed to do.
But this concussion was anything but routine. Almost immediately, Zach began to change.
I stayed home from school a couple days, and when I came back, I definitely saw a change socially where I was just not interested in having any friends then in high school and just kind of reclusive. I used to be more outgoing.
Well, we noticed right away he was very withdrawn, which is not
his
like
his personality
Zach.
Changed. I think that was the first thing that we noticed, that he became too recluse quite a bit, and we thought,
yeah, we thought, boy,
different.
This has really sent him for a loop. You know, maybe he's finally getting serious and realizing, I can't do this. I can't have concussions like this. This is very, you know, unhealthy. So we just thought, you know, he's going to kind of settle down now and realize that this is serious.
But it wasn't that. Something had happened inside Zach's brain when his head hit the floor. The effects of that change found an outlet a few weeks later when the Teesons had some friends over for dinner.
So she brought this, you know, wreck of a guitar that, you know, it was pretty tricky to play. I used to play a little bit of guitar, and I mean, the strings were too far from the frets. And
the bridge was kind of broken off. I mean, it was just really, to make his fingers stretch.
But he took a hold of it, and he started playing it, and he just kept playing it. And we're trying to call him for supper, and he was in the living room still playing it.
That night, he
was up till we made him go to bed at about 1. And then the days after that, he was just all about this guitar.
Near the end of the first month, even going off on bar chords and stuff. In terms of scales, I learned all chromatic major scale, all 12. I then also learned some minor ones.
For the first month, that's truly incredible.
It wasn't a new hobby. It was an obsessive passion.
The music kind of became my friend and my focus because I had changed my personality. It was very... a weird time for my parents to see this happening.
I mean, he was only 13 when this happened, and then his whole life changed. He went from being life of the party, class clown, to this serious, withdrawn musician, egghead. So, you know, we wanted to just make sure we could reclaim the old Zach still.
It appears that Zach's talent was somehow locked inside until the concussion gave him the ability to focus. And this is backed up by Zach's explanation of why he didn't like music as a kid.
I wasn't really into music at all. I would even say, like, hated music a bit.
Hate is a really strong word. Yeah. What is it that do you think that you disliked so much?
I would always get really just annoyed and frustrated that things didn't sound the way they should. So I thought, I kind of associated that, okay, like, this is how all music is, and it's just like a drag kind of. It was just weird how I just totally went from kind of jumping around to one thing to another and then just laser focused. It was like a switch came on in my brain, and all of a sudden it was like just nothing else would get in the way of learning guitar.
Both boys achieved greatness in their fields thanks to their ability to focus. That's something that keeps popping up in our efforts to decode genius. Perhaps being a genius is a matter of ignoring all of the noise and pouring all your brain power into a single thing. To find out, I hopped on a plane to the US capital.
I'm in Washington, D.C. I've just arrived on an early flight this morning, and I'm about to meet up with Dr. Joanne Ruth-Satz and her daughter, Kimberly Stevens. They've been studying the Thiessen brothers for a while now, and they've got some pretty unorthodox theories about child prodigies.
Hi.
I'm Lily.
Kim.
Nice to meet you, Kim.
Nice to meet you, Joanne. So nice to meet you.
So nice to meet you. Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, thanks for coming.
Dr. Ruth-Satz studies child prodigies, and her findings are disturbing to many parents.
So together you wrote a book together.
Well, she wrote the book. I did the research.
You did the research. And the book was called?
The Prodigy's Cousin. The family link between autism and extraordinary talent.
We found out that extraordinary memory was necessary to be a prodigy. So they all had this extraordinary memory. Attention to detail, which is also part of the autistic spectrum, that they're very detail-oriented. And then we found the family link of autism. Over half the families had a first or second degree relative. Some of them had multiple family members with autism. And then we did find a genetic link on chromosome 1 with the prodigies and their autistic relatives.
Comparing autistic kids with gifted ones is something that has never been done before. Dr. Ruth-Satz believes her research will help us understand both groups.
They have similar behaviors, they're just labeled differently in the two domains. One is perceived as a deficit, like a narrow range of interest and circumscribed interest. But in the prodigies, it's a rage to master.
Yeah, it's this really interesting thing where the prodigies have the strengths associated with autism, but not the challenges. So they have this extreme memory, they have the amazing attention to detail, they have these really passionate interests, but they don't have the social and communication challenges. So it's this really interesting dovetailing of the two groups.
I met both Josh and Zach, and they both are very personable and very social.
Yes.
Yeah. So are you saying that they don't have autism, or they do?
I think they have the traits that are associated with positive talent in autism, but not the deficits. And I think there's a genetic underpinning to that.
Does it suggest to you that prodigies has something to do with the hardwiring of your brain.
Yes.
The linchpin would be the memory.
Yes.
So you need to have this extraordinary memory. I think every kid my mom has studied had a working memory in the 99.9 percentile. So that's a really critical ingredient for these kids.
I think it's probably the case for most prodigies that they are storing their memories in their cerebellum, where we store our what we would call motor memories. That's why you never forget how to ride a bicycle. And we're storing our memories in our cortex. But I think that the prodigies are using their cerebellum instead, and that's why they never forget their passion or anything that they have to do with memory.
This is a complete game changer. If Dr. Ruth Satt's theory that geniuses store their memories in different parts of their brain can be proven, it will rewrite everything we know about exceptional people. What she's saying is that their memory isn't just better, it's physically different.
I think that genius is a product of being born with a very efficient neural network system.
Kim and Joanne both point to exceptional memory as being a biological fact, and that's consistent with what we've seen with all of our geniuses so far. They all have an exceptional innate ability to learn new things, and they apply that to their passion. But not everyone views memory in the same way.
Daniel, hi.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Daniel Kilov is a memory Olympian.
I was the silver medalist at the 2011 and 2012 Australian Memory Championships. I hold a national record for memorising abstract images.
Daniel's day job is a memory trainer, and even suggesting that it's possible to improve your memory puts him in the middle of a very thorny debate.
It used to be the case that it was superior memory abilities that allowed for people to become geniuses. So, you know, people used to offer accounts like Mozart, who could supposedly hear a song once and then repeat it back. But really, I think the evidence these days suggests that that's kind of got the relationship backwards, that it's all that learning, all of that storing things in memory that gives rise to the genius, not that geniuses are able to learn or remember much faster.
It's a shocking perspective. Rather than viewing memory as a natural ability that helps you learn other skills, Daniel insists that memory is a distinct skill that can be developed and improved.
Look, this is a complicated issue. There are very close correlations between certain kinds of memory, so specifically working memory and IQ, but there doesn't seem to be any real relationship between IQ and then success in memory competitions or success with the memory techniques.
So you don't think it's anything to do with the hard wiring of your brain? It's training it in a particular way.
Yeah, so crucially, in 2003, I think it was, they took some of the world's best competitive memorizers and a control group, and they scanned their brains in an MRI while they had them memorize different things, names and faces, random numbers, and snowflakes. What they found upon reviewing the data was that there were no differences at all between the brains of the memory athletes and those of the controls. Furthermore, the athletes scored within average ranges on every single test of cognitive ability. That is to say that aside from their memorizing abilities, their techniques, the memory athletes were no smarter than the general population, and they didn't have different brains.
It's a bit of a rabbit hole, but the clearest map through this seems to be this. You need great memory to be a genius, and memory is a skill that can be developed and improved. But that trained memory doesn't automatically make you smarter. Still, the question rages on. Is it innate memory ability that drives people to greatness, or hard work? This leads us to a theory that has been bouncing around for 40 years, but recently made headlines in a book by Malcolm Gladwell, based on original research by Professor Anders Ericsson. It's known as the 10,000-hour rule.
Basically, the idea is that it takes, on average, 10,000 hours of deliberate practice being the kind of crucial idea, to reach a kind of world-class standard in any particular field. It's from music to chess to dance, across these very disparate fields that, the best predictor of world-class performance is deliberate practice, time spent in deliberate practice, working at the limits of our abilities.
Daniel combines all of those theories into his own work. Practice, he says, is just a way of accumulating more memories. And if you train your brain to be better at retaining things, then you can make the most of your practice time.
Say a a chess player who's accumulated memories of hundreds and hundreds of games, when he looks at a chessboard, he sees something completely different to the amateur. Every configuration of pieces on the board has strategic meaning to him, fits into larger narratives about the game, and gives him information about what the kind of best next move is to play. The number of games played, the amount of time spent in deliberate practice, the amount that they remember is a much, much better predictor than even just kind of brute cognitive horsepower. Memory plays a crucial role in creativity, not just in retrieving old ideas and old strategies and old knowledge, but in generating new ideas and new strategies and new knowledge. Geniuses, you know, rely on their memories for their kind of stock of ideas, for their knowledge, for the things that let them have insights about the world. And of course, understanding how memory works would allow them to learn even more effectively, to provide more raw materials for that laboratory of the mind. As I say, the kind of place where the alchemy of creativity takes place. And that could be the difference between, you know, somebody who's very, very smart and somebody who comes up with a world-changing idea.
I want to have a few world-changing ideas of my own. So I've asked Daniel to get me started on improving my admittedly average memory.
What I'm going to teach you to do is memorize a list of 21 words after a single sighting, and then you'll be able to repeat it forwards or backwards.
Daniel starts by pulling up a list of random words on his laptop.
So the technique I'm going to teach you is what's known as the link method.
My job is to make a story that connects all of the words in order.
What I'm going to ask of you is that you go through this list only once.
Okay.
Take as long as you need. There's no rush, right? And take your time, go through, build the associations.
Yes.
Create the visual mental story. It's really important that you visualize it.
Yeah.
And also, of course, have fun.
Having fun is important because our minds are more inclined to retain unique, quirky, funny things.
I'm going to talk this through. So the first one is octopus, second one's bicycle. So, of course, the octopus is riding the bicycle. And the next one is candle. So maybe the octopus is riding a bicycle and he runs into the table and falls onto a candle.
Word after word, I work my way through the list, creating ridiculous links.
The tree falls on the house. The house melts into custard.
Right.
And the custard... I'm never going to be able to remember this.
You will.
Instead of reindeers... So that's the link between deer and butterfly. And someone's eating a pack of chips and watching the elephants, because that's chips is the last one.
It takes me 6.5 minutes to create a story that makes absolutely no sense, but it links all 21 words.
So what I'd like you to do now is go through back through this same list, but this time I want you to do it backwards, starting from chips.
Okay. Chips, elephant, Rubik's Cube, bottle... Cheese, the cheese, what was eating the cheese? The butterfly.
That's it, good.
Again, I'm recreating a story that makes absolutely no sense, but the process allows me to get the list right.
Which was the house originally, which was bees,
shoe,
tree, candle, bicycle, and the first one was octopus.
Fantastic, well done.
Oh, wow.
You've done exceptionally well, and of course, if you can memorize 21 words in this manner, there's nothing at all preventing you from simply extending the story and memorizing 21 more, or 210 more, or 2,100 more.
That's incredible.
The secret is to create visual mental associations, to tell a story, to transform the mundane into the memorable.
Getting back to Josh and Zach Thiessen, there are still loose ends that we need to address. Starting with Dr. Roussat's assessment of what happened when Zach smashed his head on the floor.
I think that in the event of an injury to one part of the brain, that the right hemisphere compensates, and that's why we see prodigies in the domains we see them in art, music, and math, which are all right brain kind of specialties. And so I think there might be a lesion or an area that's damaged and the right hemisphere takes over for those. Most people are left hemisphere dominant, but their right hemisphere takes over and leads them into being this progenitor person.
For the Thiessen family, Dr. Roussat's assessment of the boys really shook their world. To have a psychiatrist suggest that their happy, socially active, extremely talented child has traits related to autism, and to suggest that their youngest child was actually brain damaged from the concussion would be, I imagine, quite concerning. But for the Thiessen family, it gave them cause to dig even deeper into the source of their boy's greatness. As a result, Julie and Doug have come up with an almost unbelievable hypothesis of their own about Josh's art skills.
Well, once she kind of put the pieces together with Zach's concussion, then she asked us, did Josh have any kind of, you know, head injury? And we kind of looked at ourselves. We said, no. I mean, we don't recall any big head injury.
And then she asked about the pregnancy and about the birth. And
was
then
there anything unusual, you know, about either of their pregnancies? And I said, well, Zach's pregnancy is no problem, piece of cake. But Josh, the pregnancy with Josh, yeah, I had preterm labor from second month. Just had a whole string of events where I had to make emergency trips to Moscow. We were living in Russia at the time, and had a lot of that kind of thing.
While in Moscow, about a week and a half before Josh's due date, an intruder tried to break into their apartment.
As I went to the door, expecting somebody else to be at the door, this assailant happened to be right there, and he reached in with a black glove, wrapped, his head was wrapped like a mummy, and all I could see is white eye slits. And he reached with his black glove around and grabbed me by the throat.
And I could see it from where I was sitting in the kitchen. I could see it down the hallway that this man was forcing his way into the apartment and had Doug by the neck. I mean, there's just this huge scuffle. And even though I'm 9 months pregnant, you know, you just sort of fight or flight. Doug needs my help. I better run. And so I just automatically worked myself out of this chair I was in and ran down the hallway to help him. Tripped on a long hallway runner carpet and fell right on my pregnant belly.
Doug fought off the intruder and they found a safer place to stay. Josh was born without any further complications and, other than being a little lethargic, was a completely healthy little boy.
So we never really gave it too much more thought concerning him until the day that Dr. Ruth Satz asked that question. And when I told her about these things, she said, well, there's others of the prodigies in our study whose mothers had preterm labor. And that alone was enough to create a brain injury that created, in her theory, these exceptional abilities. So she said it could have been either the preterm labor or this fall just before Josh was born that could have been, you know, an injury to his brain that caused some sort of overcompensation.
The idea that a brain injury can unleash exceptional talent seems like great fodder for a Hollywood film. But the reality is that there's very little science to back it up because there are so few examples to be studied. That's true right across the board for studies of genius and prodigies. There's very little research for one simple reason.
Well, because they're so rare and they're so difficult to track down, it's taken me 20 years about at this point to get this cohort of child prodigies. And academia sees them kind of as anecdotes, not as real science. And so it's tough to get tenure if you're doing work with child prodigies. And yet, the answer to child prodigies may give us clues to autism and also to genius.
Getting back to the specific case of Josh the artist and Zach the musician, Josh is a part of a new generation of painters pushing the limits of realism.
I try to incorporate more imaginative elements, and I like more the conceptual side of realism as well. And I hope that they would both cerebrally and emotionally be challenged and uplifted by the work. I hope to really bring hope into people's lives through my paintings.
His brother Zach, meanwhile, is also cultivating a worldwide audience.
Just recently I had an article done in an Indian magazine, Northeast Today, and that was distributed to, I think, 250,000 people. So I have a bunch of new fans from that area, and it's really just international these days. I felt this instant connection to the guitar because it involves all three elements of music. It involves the rhythm, it involves melody, and it involves harmony, and you have those three components, and you can really emulate just so many instruments. You can really play a lot of music on guitar, and that's, I guess, why I was so attracted to it.
The awakening of his talent has also solved a problem that has been simmering in the Thiessen house for a decade.
Growing up, my brother had kind of had his thing, but from a young age, it was like, okay, that's Josh, like, he has his thing, and I felt this pressure growing up that, okay, like, when's Zach gonna kind of find his thing? I had kind of got my nose out of joint when he had his, like, first exhibition at 10, and I had
had been trying to support him, but it became a lot easier when I found guitar, and we kind of had our separate fields then, and we both are very supportive of each other ever since.
As the brothers move into their 20s and continue to grow their careers, they've found being labeled a prodigy is a double-edged sword.
I think we are just the same people that we were before.
Some people deem us like special, and some people actually may get offended by that. And I think that's why going forward with both of our careers, we just really want to focus on still making great art and just constantly improving and letting that speak for our talent rather than this label. Even though it's like, it's true, yeah, we are prodigies, but it's not defining the rest of our careers.
When we started this journey of decoding genius, I figured that we'd be talking about IQ scores and maths theorems and finding a cure for cancer. I never expected it would lead us to autism or brain injuries. I certainly never thought we'd be discussing an attempted break and enter at an apartment in Moscow. It turns out that genius is hiding in pretty unexpected places. And that's the end of this, our fifth episode of Decoding Genius. I want to thank our experts who have joined us. Don Clapper in Scottsdale, Arizona. Daniel Keylove in Sydney. Dr. Joanne Ruthsatz from Ohio State University. And her daughter, Kimberly Stevens. And also Michelle Juradovich from Clearing Skies in Brisbane. And it was an amazing experience to spend time with Josh and Zach and their parents at their home in Stony Creek, Canada. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or via your favourite podcatcher app. Share our journey with your friends and be sure to check out further details at decodinggenius.com.au. Our journey concludes next week when we look at the future of genius.
If you ask what is the upper limit on intelligence, it's clearly way beyond what ordinary humans can do today.
And we'll meet a genius in mathematics, a subject near and dear to my heart.
There's so many proofs of one thing, and that usually takes the most creativity to be able to shorten arguments into a very succinct manner. That's my favourite part.
It will be beautiful, I promise. Till next time, I'm Lily Cerner. Thanks for joining us.
This podcast was brought to you by GE. Imagination at work.